KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are broadcasting live from the San Francisco Main Library as part of the Night of Ideas. In this hour, can bottom-up governance transform cities of the future? We'll talk about real estate cooperatives, participatory budgeting, community farms, DIY neighborhood projects, and other examples of people taking power into their own hands. Can communities control their own futures? That's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are broadcasting live from the San Francisco Main Library's Night of Ideas with a live audience. Well, I guess we'll just have to do it ourselves. That's a growing sentiment in many communities where individuals are tired of waiting for government to address their needs and problems. In this hour, can bottom-up governance transform cities of the future? We're going to talk about new models for communities to offer affordable housing, healthier food, and more efficient and equitable use of tax dollars. And some of these ideas call for reclaiming the urban commons and come out of the sharing cities movement. May sound like pie in the sky, but we're going to hear about some real-world examples here in the Bay Area. Joining us, Sherry Davis. I already said, by the way, good morning to everyone. I'm so wired, you know. Let me say good evening to Sherry Davis. So she's co-executive director of the Participatory Budgeting Project. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also glad to have Noni Session with us. He's executive director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. Good to have you aboard. Hi.
Very happy to be here.
And Doria Robinson, who is here as well, executive director of Urban Tilth. Welcome.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
Good to have you here. And also good to have Gordon Douglas, who's assistant professor of urban and regional planning at San Jose State University, author of the Help Yourself City Legitimacy and Inequality DIY Urbanism. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you all here. Sherry Davis, I'm going to begin with you, and let's talk about participatory budgeting and what it is. It comes originally from Brazil. It's been here about a decade, but we talk about the whole community involved, even kids who are sometimes 12, 13 years old.
Yeah, Michael, I'm excited you asked me about participatory budgeting. It's the thing that I love to talk about, actually. And you're right, it came from Brazil almost over 30 years ago now, and it's relatively new to the United States, almost 10 years new. The first instance of participatory budgeting we saw in the United States was in Chicago in 2009. And you're right, this is an example of democracy, of a governance opportunity that involves and invites the entire community to be involved. And I think oftentimes we see opportunities for communities to engage and we consider a board or a council, and that's a really good decision-making moment for the 30-ish people that can sit on a board or council. But the question becomes, what happens to everyone else? The people that are easiest to ignore or hardest to reach? What happens to the folks that are currently or formerly incarcerated, those that really engage with intense barriers to participation? And then ultimately, as we think about who government is, I would like government to be the folks that are at my grocery store, that live in my neighborhood, that are my neighbors. And the question that I ask myself is, how do we do work so that government changes so that that can be true, so we can reduce barriers so that my friends, neighbors, schoolmates, peers can be the folks that I see in government? I worked in government for 15 years before I came over to the nonprofit side, and it was in that role that I launched the country's first youth-focused participatory budgeting effort.
It was in Boston.
In the city of Boston. Yeah. 12 to 25-year-olds directly decided on $1 million of the city's capital budget. And the coolest thing about that project is I no longer work for the city of Boston, but this is the way that they do business. And so when we're seeing governments or institutions adopt participatory budgeting, it's marking a change in the way that they do business, the way that they think about community engagement, and the way that they make decisions together with community instead of behind a closed door with a small group of people.
Well, let's talk about the process and how it starts with a steering committee, community leaders usually. I mean, that's essentially the beginning of it.
absolutely right. I think unlike most community processes or government processes, this is an example where a community comes together to form a steering committee. And that steering committee may be a couple of community leaders. In Boston, we're talking about teenagers. When we did this process in Oakland, it was young people from all ages. They wrote the rules that govern the process in a very transparent fashion. And then we go into idea collection, where we collect hundreds, if not thousands, of ideas on how to spend a pot of public funds. Then we transition into my favorite phase of participatory budgeting, which is proposal development. This is the phase where we look at all of the ideas that came in, distill them down, think about need, feasibility, impact, and equity, and then we formulate those ideas so that they can make it onto a final ballot. Nothing makes it onto the final ballot unless it can really happen. So we work with city and agency staff during that proposal development phase and go out to a full vote. Unlike a local or national election, this is an instance where the vote comes out to where folks are. It can be at schools, transit stations, wherever people say that that vote needs to be. And it lasts longer than a day.
I think it's terrific that it goes into the schools. I mean, because you're really training young people in citizenship. And this is something that has taken shape in Chicago and New York. I mean, it's not necessarily all that new, though. It's been around about a decade. But you got districts in Oakland that are doing it, of course, as well. Just say something, if you would, about how this affects the people in the communities you see it. I mean, I like the example of somebody saying, boy, we need a park bench, so let's get participatory budgeting to get a park bench built.
I think this is about a movement beyond elections. I think not only are we seeing folks being able to point to tangible change in their community, right? And it could be increased Wi-Fi access that students are identifying their need that they need. It could be a sidewalk improvement. It could be you name it that young people and community members of all ages are coming up with. But the biggest thing for me is young people that participate in PB are reporting that they're more likely to vote in local and national elections, more likely to volunteer community-based organizations, more likely to empower or feel empowered in their own voice and engage in the government system and consider politics themselves. And so for me, that shift in government is really what we're talking about.
Sherry Davis, again, is co-executive director of the Participatory Budgeting Project, and Noni Session, who is with us here as well, as executive director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. And this is also kind of new in many people's minds, and they're certainly excited about it. Talk about what you're doing. This is, I think, probably best described as people being pushing back and pushing out.
Pushing back and pushing out. I think, actually, I might say pushing upward. These seeds have been planted in Oakland for a long time. We have a long history of activism and community solidarity, and we've experienced about 20 years of the arc of a plan to shift the populations in Oakland to the detriment of historical populations who have held space and built and served in Oakland for several generations. So what we're looking to do is, as opposed to what's been happening where the doors of Oakland and the Bay Area in general being thrown open to unchecked speculative commercial development, we're choosing to find community leaders who have a vision for our communities and put them in charge of small site development projects where we tap into the expertise that's already there in the community and allow them to lead in a way that our municipalities don't really facilitate.
I use that language about pushing back, though, because I think we're talking about people who are being displaced for the most part, and you're talking about really, in many ways, a permanent affordability and allowing essentially a cooperative that can exist with permanent affordability for people.
Yes. However, the permanent affordability is almost part of the ethical undergirding of what we're doing here. What we're actually trying to do is reinvest communities and community ownership and community leadership through a land sovereignty model. Most identities, most communities, definitions of self and history are built on the land. And when people are displaced from the land where they've built these stories over generations, those things disappear as well. So we are an organization that functions as the communal, technical, financial go-between communities that often don't have access to capital markets, don't have access to real estate markets, in order to put them in charge of their own futures. The permanent affordability comes through creating models that are morally sustainable in this this development.
This is crowd financing. This is done through membership, essentially membership sales, about $1,000 to get in and guarantee of about 1.5% interest. It's also aimed to the great extent to indigenous people and African-American people and Latinos.
Yeah. You might call them frontline communities. And it's aimed in that direction because the black, indigenous, people of color communities are the most affected by what we call the housing crisis. As communities get pushed out, all of us get pushed out, but the black, indigenous, and people of color communities have been experiencing displacement for generations. So this is another way of reinvesting communities of ownership and sustaining their presence here before they are pushed out to less resource cities, before they're pushed out to more difficult situations than they're already experiencing.
That's why I say push back. Land without landlords.
Yes, what you're talking land about. Without landlords.
So how does this work? I mean, for example, there's a property that's available, and where do you go to action, and what do you do?
Well, I'll use our current property that we've just gone into escrow as an example. This is a community of organizers. There's a young lawyer who defends domestic abuse survivors in civil court. They sue their domestic abusers. There's another cooperative, the only people of color coffee roaster cooperative in Oakland and Berkeley. There are people who are students at UC Berkeley, people who are artists and organizers, and their building went up for sale. And they came to East Bay Cooperative, East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative, and asked us if we would buy the building for them. So what we've done in order to be able to do that is we've already begun to lay the groundwork. We've already begun to build the mission-aligned bank relationships, the impact investor relationships, and building a capital investment campaign that can be expanded out to the community. Prior to 2014, there was a central securities laws where unless you were an accredited investor, an individual with a net worth of $1 million or more, you were not able to invest in a community endeavor for more than $300. Sustainable Economies Law Center managed to raise that cap to $1,000. So that means if you have 400 investors, you have the seed to place on a property. So they brought the property to us. We began to build a relationship with the landlord. We began to shop the property around to our mission-aligned banks. We launched our community investment campaign and thus far have raised about $250,000 toward the down payment. We've secured a low-interest loan from our land trust partners, and we've begun the resident education process where one of the covenants we make with our residents is that they govern collectively, nonviolently, in order to build the leadership skills back in. So we train them around property management, around collective leadership, and after about 3 to 4 years, they will have full ownership over the property and full vision of how they guide their community.
This is pretty exciting stuff. I mean, can I ask you just, because there's a whole hierarchy and you've got the law center and you've got the banks and everything, who watches the money? Oh. Who has control of the purse strings?
That's a really great question. Actually, this is a collective ownership model. There are four classes of owners, and we all collectively govern it together. There are the community owners, and that's a buy-in for $10 because their capital should not be a barrier to community control. So you can buy in as a community owner for $10 a year, a week, or a month, and you steer our ship. There's the investor owner that gives us the flexibility to move very quickly on properties because I'm sure you all know how quickly property markets move. And investor owners buy in for $1,000 per. They have voting capacity over the finance director, but in order to really guide the ship, you're actually required to be a community owner and come to our meetings and build community together because we're looking not only to reconnect communities with land, but reconnect communities and neighborhoods together. We ran a great city council campaign in 2016 where we came within 1,500 votes of winning against an entrenched incumbent. And from our door knocking, what we realized is there's a radical disconnection between neighbors, between communities. And if we're talking about inclusive cities, if we're talking about cities that bring down our environmental impact where they're walkable cities, these people, individuals, myself, yourself, have to be reconnected to make these choices together. And along with the cooperative ethic, there's full transparency around this. So we are working on building handbooks to make our pro formas free, able to give away, handbooks around collective governance.
You got some pretty good cartoons that people can learn about this from, in fact, right on your website.
Yeah, this is about accessibility. The reason that many of us as Americans find ourselves helpless in the face of the decisions that commercial markets are making for us is because knowledge is increasingly opaque and limited to the most resourced of individuals. So Janelle Orsi, one of the founders of Sustainable Law Center, she draws all of her legal explanations in cartoons, but they're very complex. Please take a look at our bylaws. They are very innovative bylaws that really build in sustainable community control, that really resists mission alignment, and really brings people's leadership and expertise, of which they've been dispossessed for generations, it brings it back up to the surface.
Yeah, I mentioned the cartoons because I think they were designed for high school students, and they really are very accessible. Let me go to you, Dori Robinson. Dori Robinson is Executive Director of Urban Tilth. We started talking in the last hour about food, and you've got the future of cities in mind with this regional food supply on a small scale, but some pretty large ideas, and I want to get these out to our audience here. And it also has to do again with decentralizing with food production.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what it is. The last section was actually really getting me thinking about, you know, the why of what we do is a climate change question. And
what does Urban Tilth do? Tell us.
So Urban Tilth is an urban agriculture organization in Richmond, California, completely run by Richmond residents, mostly youth. It's like 31 low-income folks who basically have taken back, in collaboration with city government, county government, school districts, seven different plots of land that had been vacant lots for some of them 40 years, just full of kind of trash and dumped on, nothing good was happening there. And we actually hire and train local residents to restore those lands. And
in Richmond, you're talking about some pretty bad soil because of Chevron in many ways.
Not necessarily. I mean, that is the thing that people have to understand about Richmond. Yes, there are definitely brownfields, but not every place in Richmond is spoiled. Not every person in Richmond is. You know,
so you've got soil struggling. That you can work with.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got plenty of soil that we can work with, and we work it. So that's what we've been doing for 14 years. And we kind of started with community gardens, right? Like just getting people an excuse to get out of their barred houses and feel safe to go and talk to somebody else. Like that was our first kind of priority, right? It's just to create these places together because there actually is no place together.
You're talking about a place for community, really.
Yeah. There isn't really. If you look around Richmond in terms of the way the city has been laid out, it's been gutted so much. There is no place that you can point to that people gather. The Burger King, you know? I'm serious. That's probably, you know, the McDonald's. And so
for good nutrition.
Yeah, exactly. Right? For our health crisis that we're all facing in terms of healthcare. And so we really just wanted that. And when we got into it and we got deeply into it and really started building things and transforming space together with young people who have been told their whole lives that they are as expendable as those lots we were working on. They were trash, like the trash they were cleaning up, as they actually took it into their own hands to transform these places and then actually feed food to people that heals. Something else just started to happen.
Let me just ask you, though, how big is the farm and who gets the food?
Right. So on our largest farm, we have two farms. One is 1 acre, one is 3 acres. Anybody who walks up gets food. That's one of our kind of rules. If you come, you don't leave without food. But we also have a multiple ways that we distribute the food that we grow. We do pop-up free farm stands around Richmond in places where that don't have a grocery store. They only have convenience stores with chips and candy and crap. And we also do a CSA, a pretty powerful CSA that gets food to now 200 families once a week. We're going to go to twice a week starting this new season. It's about 10 pounds of food. It's the same box of food, but depending upon how much you can pay, you pay a different amount. The larger amount that gets paid actually makes it possible to make the least amount possible. It's called a pay-it-forward box. So people will consciously purposely pay more so they can be in relationship with somebody, another family, who can't afford it but deserves to have the same food, the same high-quality, chemical-free, organic food.
I think that's great. Are you also planning for climate change, thinking about it?
Direction? I mean, that's one of the things, right? So you can only grow so much on a 1 or 3 acre farm, right?
Yeah.
And so what we did is we're like, we really want to feed a lot of people, and we don't have the grocery stores. And actually, in fact, we don't really want a big box grocery store to drop down and kind of kill the local markets. You know, we'd actually like to do things differently. But in order to do that, we actually had to reach out and think about food regionally, right? Like, how do you shorten international supply chains?
You want to shorten those supply chains.
Exactly. Shorten international supply chains basically by making relationships with regionally local farmers. And that's what we've done. We actually reach out and we actually get some of the food that comes into our boxes from folks that are the next generation of farmers in Brentwood, California, who are taking over the farms from their families, and they're trying to stay alive, and they're actually fighting, you know, the incoming development on their properties. You can stand from the farms of the first generation farmers and see the developments right on their historic land, you know, this rich farmland. So we actually make a relationship with those guys and create what we're seeing is what we need to do is to be in relationship with each other more and with land more in order to survive climate change, right? So we need to actually go into the rural areas and talk to people as urban people, make a financial relationship that benefits both of us, make an exchange that benefits both of us, shorten those supply chains, and then actually be able to feed all of our communities better. And that's kind of what we're doing.
Well, congratulations on what you're doing. I think it's innovative, and I think it has some real relevance to what we've been talking about this whole evening. I do want to get to you, Gordon Douglas, and I want to certainly give you enough time here to find out what you've been doing. 5 years of research on people who make non-authorized, contributions to their community. We're talking about things like guerrilla gardening, and there's a whole list of things here. DIY stuff, especially doing it yourself. And let's talk about, I want to talk about first with you with this Buddha in Oakland, because I find it so fascinating. Somebody decided to put a Buddha in, it's right around where you live, I think, around 11th Avenue and in the East Oakland area. And it's this beautiful Buddha, and they claim that littering went down, graffiti went down, crime went down. People, Vietnamese people started putting vegetables there and everything. Flowers, all sorts of things, you know, to Buddha, I guess. Some quick thoughts. I want to get back to this after the break. But this is symbolic of how somebody can actually take community action and do it yourself.
Sure. I mean, that's a great example of how these things can be real community assets. And when you have some people who are, in that case, a neighbor of mine was tired of the dumping and the litter and stuff like that at this little kind of street intersection median thing, and decided he was going to epoxy a stone Buddha to a rock, hoping that would be better than nothing. And, you know, over time, now this is it's going on 10 years almost, this has become an enormous, beautiful, multi-structure kind of a thing that is active every single day with the local community.
And they claim crime has gone down. In fact, they claim some pretty dramatic going down of crime. We'll talk about this some more and other things and do it yourselves. One guy was asked who made it, why not Christ? And he said, he's a more of a neutral dude. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and in this hour, we're talking about whether bottom-up governance can transform cities of the future. We have a live studio audience with us. Let's welcome them. And we have a splendid panel, Sherry Davis, co-executive director of Participatory Budgeting Project, and Noni Session, executive director of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative, Doria Robinson, executive director of Urban Tilth, and Gordon Douglas, assistant professor of urban and regional planning with San Jose State and author of The Help Yourself City, Legitimacy and Inequality in DIY Urbanism. And we were talking, before we get back to you, Douglas, If you have some questions, by the way, or if you'd like to enter into this discussion, we certainly welcome your involvement. Those of you in the audience, just raise your hand and we'll try to find you with a microphone and we'll go to your questions forthwith here. But I want to go back to Douglas and talk about DIY urbanism. What is that? I mean, I guess people often think about that in terms of the parking day thing, you know, with that outdoor space. I mean, this is, I guess, the best example because it's become national. Talk about that.
Sure, yeah. So the stuff I've looked at in my research on DIY urbanism or bottom-up urbanism more broadly, I suppose, is all of these kind of unauthorized but civic-minded improvements or would-be improvements that people make in their communities, sometimes in forms that are very similar to sort of the stuff that a city ought to be doing, right? And so you mentioned parking day, which started in 2005 with a group of kind of activist architecture and design students deciding to take a parking space here in San Francisco, feed the meter, and then instead of parking a car, have a temporary park in the space, right? And this garnered a ton of attention. Within a year had been sort of celebrated and endorsed by the city of San Francisco and who declared the third Friday of September to be Parking Day. And this has now become a nationwide and indeed worldwide phenomenon. But we also see lots of really simple, almost innocuous sometimes little things. People putting out benches, places to sit, guerrilla gardening, like you mentioned, these kind of small, what some people call urban acupunctures of sort of little efforts to make the city better.
DIY signage.
Lots of signage, yeah. Which, is nothing new about that, right? We all are familiar with people putting up signs in their front yard about any number of things or tacking something up to a community message board, that kind of stuff. But also people trying to, say, correct something where they feel like the city ought to be stepping in. So I documented a lot of stuff that just says, like, no parking on the sidewalk. People have made that sign. Or cross traffic does not stop. People have made that sign because nobody had and there was an accident or somebody was parking on the street.
Can I give out a caveat here? I mean, some of these things are unauthorized. Some of them are illegal that are done DIY. I mean,
right.
One has to be careful, right?
Sure. And I look specifically at unauthorized stuff. Many of them are illegal.
But can you give us a couple of choice examples?
Well, sure. So a lot of the folks I talked to in the Bay Area, down in Los Angeles and in New York and elsewhere, were, for instance, painting guerrilla bike lanes. So that's, you know, going out and striping a bike lane using a lane striper or something like that you might have gotten at Home Depot or wherever, and painting a bike lane where you think that there ought to be one. And on the one hand, these are folks who have done a lot of research, oftentimes I find, and looked into maybe where the city bike plan says there should be a bike lane, but there isn't one yet. But then this kind of gets into my sort of concerns and critiques of this stuff in terms of, you know, who I think everybody here could imagine, who is it easier for to go paint a bike lane at 4 in the morning, and who might be disincentivized from doing that kind of thing.
But the best of this, you're talking about maybe, some rather consequential things that can even lead to prison time or jail time at least. But the better part of this is actually getting community engagement and getting things going that are needed in the community.
You know, absolutely, yeah. And I documented dozens and dozens of things that I think are really inspiring and hopeful. And the simple fact that people are willing to take it upon themselves to do this and even to sometimes break the law ought to be inspiring in terms of people's kind of enthusiasm for their communities and their ability to work together.
Don't you also hear the critique, though, that sometimes this is just window dressing?
Yeah. Not just that it's window dressing. I guess my concern is that it's not open to everybody because of things like the color of somebody's skin can make it a hell of a lot harder to, paint a bike lane at 4 in the morning without risk of arrest or being viewed a certain way or perhaps being even, you know, killed by a police officer.
You can be more privileged than doing things that are perhaps against the law sometimes.
So that's right. Yeah. And so I think we just have to work to find ways to make this sort of participation accessible, because otherwise it risks just kind of reproducing the same sorts of privileges and aesthetics that we already see in kind of mainstream planning.
And again, Gordon Douglas is Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at San Jose State and author of The Help Yourself City. If you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, raise your hand and we will find you. But first, I'd like to go back to the panel and ask a question about the role these projects we're hearing about play in your minds in democracy. You see a future for small community-based governance. Noni, a big band with you?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, it's a nationwide movement that communities are starting to understand that when we form our own structures of governance, that voice is louder than the municipality's intentions for our direction, right? And people have to be empowered around what they can govern and what their capacities are and what their potentials are and outcomes that will actually be heard and applied. So we're setting up a framework where we can not only build the expertise and the power into the community members, but also create an environment where they will be those changes, those intentions are applied directly to our communities and applied directly to the markets that affect us and applied directly to the prices that are pushing communities out of the place they've been for generations.
And let me follow this up with you, Sherry Davis. Sherry Davis, again, is co-executive editor of Participatory Budgeting Project. Participatory budgeting can really represent a new form of governance, bottom-up governance. That's essentially what you're envisioning, isn't it?
I think it's a major part of what governance should look like. But I honestly believe that there's no one intervention or innovation that solves all of the complex issues that we're talking about. It's the frameworks together that Noni was just referencing. It's bringing people together to really think through complex components. And I think it's innovative solutions like participatory budgeting coupled with other things. Every community is different. The needs of every community are different. No two PB processes look the same for that reason, and no two solutions in any community are likely going to look the same for that reason.
And what about you, Dory Robinson?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the idea of democracy is too isolated to these moments of voting, right? Like, you know, when we vote for, you know, different kind of political offices and whatnot. I feel like we need to actually, the future is expanding that notion of democracy to apply to every decision that we need to make collectively that governs our lives and impacts our lives. Like, people not only need to just participate in democracy by voting, but also participate in democracy by having some kind of a stake, some kind of a skin in the game around the consequences of their vote, the responsibility that comes with making more decisions. People need to make more decisions and be involved in more decisions.
You have some thoughts about having them realize the skin that's in the game, so to speak?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing that we're doing in Richmond is we started Cooperation Richmond, which is a worker-owned cooperative incubator and a small loan fund to get people democratizing their workplaces, right? It's a place where we spend the most time in our life, and it's actually the least democratic, right? You don't have any say over what happens to you at work normally. You're just told what to do. And we feel like that is a huge area where people can practice democracy, practice empathy, practice problem solving, practice, you know, conflict resolution every day. That's the kind of thing that we're going to need just in terms of where we're going with climate change and the state of crisis that we're facing. We need these skills. We need these skill sets. We need to be more involved in our lives.
Gordon, you want to add your voice here? Gordon Douglas?
Sure. I all these examples that we're hearing up here, you know, from Doria and Shari and Noni are really inspiring examples of exactly how this kind of more democratic participation in making our cities better, you know, I think ought to be working. And I think the concern is just that kind of comes from my work is just that we have to be mindful of how there's a difference between participation and democracy, and that we have to be always striving to make sure that we aren't just celebrating participation for the sake of participation, and actually making sure that the ability to participate is open to everybody.
Well, there is that ability right now. If you have something in the audience that you'd like to, we'll have participatory democracy here in action, and we're going to have Stephanie join us first. Stephanie, welcome.
I'm really interested in the governance model, and I wanted to understand two things about it. What was the inspiration, and what systems of flexibility to change and adapt that governance model do you have already set in place, because things are changing all the time, and like situations to circumstance, et cetera?
I think, Noni, we should probably go to you on this first. Noni Session?
As Sherry mentioned,
because you got a whole hierarchy in your organization.
Well, actually, we do not have a hierarchy, right?
It's a collective hierarchy.
it's something that
It's a corporate cooperative, and that's almost oxymoronic, right?
Well, I like that, though. Listen, a hedge fund is a cooperative fund.
Absolutely.
Right? It's just that the ethics of the hedge fund may not be in alignment with where our communities want to go. So our solidarity fund is a collective fund, and we all have collectively put in our work and our decision-making power. The structure of our cooperative corporation, the structure of Sustainable Economies Law Center, is a flat power structure. It's transparent information sharing. We all make the same salary. We all have equal decision-making power. Even as the executive director, I have to run my decisions by my co-operators, right? This is the effort to displace our learned and entrenched Western hierarchical pathways that we're stuck in, even in our daily workplace. How do we challenge cities and municipalities about the way that they govern our lives if we have not relearned how to govern our own lives together?
Can I say something about your background? Because I think it's important. You studied in Nairobi and you studied cultural anthropology, right?
Yes, and I studied international development and the way that power and capital flows transform a cultural setting in relationship to ideas of sovereignty that get displaced through institutional power.
And how many generations in Oakland?
Third generation Oakland.
Yeah.
So the arc has become very apparent to me now that I'm in my 40s. So.
You want to say something here, please?
Yeah, I just...
This is Sherry Davis.
One thing that Noni is really bringing up for me, that, and this is a conversation I have all the time, I'm just thinking about a conversation I just had with my cousin Matt about this exact thing, and it's... Two things. We have to design with and not for. That's one. And the second piece that everyone forgets is that that takes time. This cooperative governance model with several people that have to reach decisions and go through complex conversations together, that doesn't happen in 5 minutes. Maybe you have some secret sauce.
No.
But what I've found in my career in doing this deep community engagement work is that folks now are starting to understand the design with and not for concept, but this, there's no understanding of how much time that requires and is absolutely a necessary component to this recipe.
And since we were talking about third generation in the case of Noni, I want to go back to you, Doria, and give you your proper lineage props here, because as I understand it, we got about 150 families now, but you had a grandfather in Richmond who had 17 families working public land?
Well, not exactly working public land. So 17 families actually came up from the South together. They were all...
This is all part of the Black migration.
Yeah. Right. They were all very, very poor people living in countryside in Louisiana, some in, from Arkansas. And they came up to Richmond together, and they actually, you know, did all everything that we're talking about here way before it was cool or had a name for it, you know. They pooled their money together to buy properties under a single trust. And actually, one of the things they did was they bought up 354 acres of land in Fairfield, California, and have run a ranch there ever since. And they run it collectively, they own it collectively, they bought and built the church. They actually put each other's children through training programs to become electricians and contractors and whatnot. And they actually then use that to build these buildings. You know, my grandfather was just this kind of visionary. And along with the other elders, other Hunter and other folks, who just held people together with this vision that we are poor alone, but together we are rich, we are wealthy. We have the wealth of all of our generations, of all of our families, and we can do a lot. And they did. You know, they transformed those families' lives. And I feel like that was some of the deepest lessons I ever got. You know, my grandfather, he always said that, you know, when you come into the room, he would always say, you know, you have Willie with you? You know, you have Willie with you? And he would be like, ah, you know, he's always up at the crack of dawn. And Willie was Willie to work, you know, because he was Willie to work. He was like just this man who thought that we were only held back by our imagination and our willingness to work with other people.
You both have wonderful pedigrees and lineage here. I mean, we're talking about roots in the community as well. So it ties in with the work you're doing now. Next question comes from Galen. Galen, join us.
Hi, my name is Galen. We know that I'm a seven-year resident in Oakland. We know that developers wield a lot of power, and it feels like city representatives can be beholden to them. We kind of get these paltry carve-outs like, oh, we'll give you 20% affordable units, but it'll be in a separate building on the same property. How do we get the power away from them and to the people?
Well, Noni, I think you can take this one on.
Indeed. I think there are several things to think about in that term. One is remember which council persons supported which initiatives and caused which developers to really serve community benefit. We have a very short memory, and our news outlets, to some extent, provide us with that opportunity, and other extents block us from that opportunity. That's number one. And in that remembering, we have to think about, we have to ask ourselves, what is it we want out of this concept of affordable housing, right? The numbers for affordable housing in Oakland, only 3.2% of units are going toward affordable housing, right? The question is that even the solution, right? The concept of affordable housing actually creates and exacerbates several problems. It isolates and enhances poverty. It insists that people stay at a poverty level in order to qualify for charity instead of breaking charity models.
Can I cut to the chase here? Uh-huh. You're talking about housing as a human right, really, aren't you?
I'm talking about housing as a human right, but also the rejection of housing as a commodity, right? So water as a commodity is diametrically opposed to water as a human right. So you have to get down to the core of what's driving the dysfunction. And the dysfunction is turning basic needs into commodity processes.
Which we have done splendidly in this republic of ours.
Indeed.
do you want to comment here? Gordon Douglas? Because it gets back to the need for people to do things on their own, doesn't it? Autonomy and agency and all that.
Well, you know, yes and no.
A lot of it.
I think we would, a lot of us would like to see also a state that's kind of doing more of what we want them to do too, you know? It's not just about, I think it's about wresting power from certain interests, for sure, development interests that are thinking only about the bottom dollar and thinking only about growth. You know, on the other hand, like I think we would like to see actually not just handing power kind of willy-nilly to the people, but finding ways to like make the people's voice heard so that the state is actually, you know, doing the things it's supposed to be doing, so that our elected officials are doing what they're supposed to be doing. I think that's got to be a big part of it too, because otherwise, when you have those with power kind of making those decisions, it's very easy for anybody to sort of say, like, you know, here's our bottom up process, here's our participatory process, and now you know, the result is something that, as you put it, is maybe like more like window dressing or more like just about economic development in the end anyway.
Well, let me go to Sherry again on this, because what do you find in participatory budgeting that has really been a triumph or has really brought forth the collective voice of the people in a way that maybe democracy in its normal channels failed?
I think there are a couple of big things. One is when we practice participatory budgeting, there's an accountability measure that's built in between those that are in an agency and government and everyone else. Everyone is involved in that conversation, and so that's a really important piece here. And I think one thing that I appreciate, whether we're doing participatory budgeting with a community benefits agreement or in some other space, is the outcomes of that process and the goals of that process are very clear on the front end, and I think that that's important. But for me, the bigger question is, how do we start to really look at other things like procurement and government and begin to really evaluate those sorts of processes that are major threats to equity?
We actually got a tweet here that I'm going to read. I didn't give our Twitter handle, but there's a tweet that came in. Neil said, waiting for the question, can it scale? Yes, if it gets the same support as capitalism gets, but grows by scaling out, not up. And we'll go to another question from the audience. Anne, that's you. Welcome.
This is for Sherry Davis. What about linking up participatory budgeting with local foundations like the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation or the Silicon Valley Foundation? They speak of using their funds to help local communities, but wouldn't it be nice if the communities were able to decide how those funds are spent?
Thank you so much for that question. And that's absolutely something that we think about. And I think there are two things. If we're talking about public dollars and allowing community members an opportunity to have a say on how their public dollars are spent, I think we need to be able to find spaces in a public budget where we can make decisions together. Secondly, I think in order for us to make this work, there is a training that has to happen. There's facilitation, other components that are necessary in running this process. And I would love to see philanthropic institutions like the ones that you mentioned really step up and work with local governments to bring in organizations like the Participatory Budgeting Project or others so that they're not using those public dollars to learn how to do and administer the process, but so that they can execute it. And I think that's a really big piece to scale.
Yeah, and I know, Noni Session, you want to weigh in here, yeah?
I wanted to say something about large philanthropic dollars, right? Some of the logic under the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative is to begin with community capital. So we can really communicate and retune our neighborhoods to understand that we can aggregate our own resources to put our own visions into motion, and then large philanthropic capital follows our vision instead of the other way around, where our projects become donor driven and donor dominated, and even through the symbolics of where we hold the meetings, whose name is on the paperwork, really has a chilling effect on community power and community control. You start with community and you let Chan Zuckerberg follow our vision, as opposed to the other way around.
We have another question from the audience. Just step forward or raise your hand, and we will get to as many of you as we can in the time remaining.
Hi. My name is Tiantum, and I had a question circling back to what Doria was talking about, democratizing the workplace. And in the past, that has been like unions and labor, the labor movement has been a huge part in giving workers a voice. And we're currently, in the current political climate, facing a lot of anti-labor sentiments from the government, from corporations, from even for our Supreme Court. And we have a select group of powerful people who are influencing the workplace and like creating this apathy amongst workers who would most benefit from it. And so my question is, how are we addressing that and working on rebuilding that movement from the bottom up in a new way to address the changes that have occurred in the last 120 years?
That's a big scale. But you know, I'm going to go to you on this, Doria Robinson, because you're putting so many young people to work in Richmond. I mean, it's really inspiring.
Right. I mean, so I have a little bit to say. I don't really know. I'm not an expert on unions. But I did go to Mondragon, Spain, recently and meet with the Mondragon Corporation, which is about cooperatives. And they said to me that they had actually been meeting with some of the major unions here to talk about cooperatives. And I found that really interesting, you know, to think about the scale that they're working on in Spain, which is kind of airplane factories and, you know, Safeway chain store, 1,600 grocery store cooperative, worker-owned cooperatives. That scale, to think about that scale as a possibility, and to think that our unions, or at least some people within unions, are thinking about that of real worker say and ownership over their work. That to me is really inspiring. I don't think that, like we were said earlier, there's no one answer to all of these issues, but we definitely have some really interesting tools that we could experiment with.
And Judy's next in our audience. Judy, join us.
Hi, I'm a public educator, a public school librarian, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how communities can take charge of reinvesting in their school systems. I know, for instance, the Oakland school system is on a starvation budget right now, and it's devastating for people there. So I was wondering if you had any ideas about that.
Well, one thing we've seen with participatory budgeting is that this was used as a tool to organize school students, parents, and the broader school community around decisions that are happening at their school with their school budget and beyond. And I think participatory budgeting in schools, and we've talked about this in the workplace, giving folks an opportunity to practice authentic democracy and work along these systems. When we bring things like real democracy into schools and allow students in the school community to engage, there's a spillover effect where folks have an opportunity to ask questions about other things. And that's one of the biggest things things that we find with innovations like PB and in other spaces. I think let's do some real democracy in schools, and that's how we begin to empower folks to ask bigger questions.
And getting to the biggest question of all, perhaps, that we've been wrestling with to a degree here, we're talking about whether bottom-up governance could transform cities of the future, and you're saying with participatory budgeting, the answer is definitely most affirmative.
Yeah, without question. But it's not PB alone. I think it's participatory budgeting with our amazing partners, the minds that are in this room and other spaces. And I think we have to be more flexible about what we think of as a solution for government and understand that there's not a uniform solution everywhere.
Larger scale, if we could go to both of you for a moment here, to Noni and Doria. I mean, this does represent the possibility of really transforming cities of the future.
Yes, I believe so. And in relationship to the tweet of how does it scale, this is a question that's being asked of our organization by a lot of commercial developers.
Can I ask you a quick question? How much capital do you have now?
Oh, do you really want to know?
Yes.
Well, on the scale of U.S. capital, it's very small, but we have about $300,000. So, and that's from a community. And in terms of its scaling, in terms of being able to move these projects very quickly, it scales through tapping it into creating a series of community owners, right? You set one project up, then you can overlap and move to the next project. By the end of this year, we'll have four projects in motion, and we're a five-person staff collective because we're finding leaders who are invested and want to do this work for their community and giving them the tools they need and letting them be free with their vision.
Seconds left. Can I go to you, Doria?
I just have to address the capital question. You know, our communities have been historically extracted. Our capital through our labor, our capital through our actual properties have been extracted for, you know, decades, if not hundreds of years. And there needs to be a reckoning around that. And yes, as we do this work, you know, we actually need to think about the extractive economy that's gotten us to the situation we are in terms of climate change and the other things that we're facing. And
reckoning. You hear the music coming up here. I'm sorry. I really enjoy hearing all of you and what you all had to say. And thank you so much for your participation. Thanks to all of you in the audience, of course, as well. And thanks to everyone at KQED who made this possible. And thanks to the San Francisco Public Library, SF MoMA, and the French Consulate of San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.